So I'd like to present to you some spinorial and twistorial methods for loop quantum gravity and spin forms that had been developed in the last couple of years. So these should be considered as part of a larger program, which is to understand the geometrical interpretation of the quantum state of loop quantum gravity and of the spin form transition amplitudes, and to find some systematic way to parameterize the deformation of those geometries, which will allow us to define the dynamics of the theory. So from the canonical point of view, we have the spin network states of loop quantum gravity, which define some kind of quantum geometry. But one natural question is whether they can be effectively understood as some discrete geometry, classical geometry. And then we also have a spin form, which define the path integral formulation for this spin network, and which are algebraic constructs, which define the projector and physical states for loop quantum gravity. And the natural question is whether this path integral can be interpreted as some discrete space-time geometry. So the spin formalism is based on a very technical starting point. It's that we can introduce some spin variables as Darboux coordinates on the phase space of loop quantum gravity on a fixed graph. So these spin variables are going to replace the usual holonomy flux variables and are going to have a canonical Poisson bracket. So from this technical starting point, it has led to many developments. So first, we can understand the geometry of these spin networks in terms of twisted geometries, as beautifully introduced by Laurent Frédel and Simone Speciale. It's also led to a whole UN framework that studies the property of the intertwiners and the structure of intertwiner spaces. It allowed us to define coherent intertwiners and generating functions for spin form amplitudes. The spin variables also got upgraded to twister networks, which allow to embed, to study the embedding of the SU2 structure of loop gravity into the Lorentz group. And we can also apply the spinner techniques to spin forms and write the spin form amplitudes as the integrals of the spinners and twisters. And finally, there's been recently some very nice work by Maïté Dupuis and Florence Girelli, which extended all this formalism to quantum groups to account for cosmological constant in loop quantum gravity. So all this stuff has been developed over the last 3-4 years, but I like to track it all back to some work I did with Florent Girelli in 2005 when I was still a postdoc here at the Private Institute. It was some exciting times. And we were studying the space of intertwiners, and we found some kind of UN structure in the operators acting on the intertwiner space, and we didn't understand much. And then Laurent came, and we understood a bit more of the action of the UN on the space of intertwiners, and we defined coherent intertwiners. And then Simone joined in, and then we developed this whole beautiful thing of twisted geometries. And then we understood that everything could be formulated in terms of spinners. What's actually weird in this whole thing is that we always started by the quantum case. We studied intertwiners, the spin networks, and all that. And slowly, we understood the classical counterpart of all this formalism and what was behind. And it was much simpler than all that. And so we then worked backwards, forwards, and finally to a beautiful work by Simone Speciale and Wolfgang Gindlen that last year managed to show how to formulate the spin form amplitude and especially the EPRL FK spin form model in terms of integrals of a twister space. So I'd like to start by a quick overview of all that's been done in the spin formalism. And then I will give more details on the spin phase space and its quantization and how to recover all the standard structures that loop quantum gravity. Then I will talk a bit on the UN framework for intertwiners and then show how spinners can be applied to spin forms and describe in 1 minute twister networks. So first of all this spinner formalism, it offers a fresh look on the phase space of loop quantum gravity. So it's going to introduce new variables, the spinner variables, to encode the geometry. And I always find it interesting to study new variables to encode the geometry because it often offers a new perspective on how to define quantum gravity. So we are going to work on a fixed graph, and we're going to introduce these spinner variables, which have a canonical Poisson bracket. And this means that the kinematical structure is going to be very simple, and that we can quantize everything in a straightforward way. And it turns out that this is a very efficient framework to investigate and analyze quantum quantization ambiguities in loop quantum gravity. Since it's also a bunch of harmonic oscillators. We can build coherent states for these harmonic oscillators, and we'll have a straightforward construction of coherent spin network state for the quantum geometry of loop gravity. So as I said, it's a new perspective on the degrees of freedom of the geometry. So we have now a single set of variables, which are the spinor variables, and both the usual variables, like the holonomies and fluxes of gravity, will be reconstructed as a function in these variables. We also understand very nicely the geometrical interpretation of these spinor networks in terms of frame polyhedra, which you can glue back together into some twisted geometries for the space slice. But the main feature of this formalism is that it allows to switch focus between localizing the degrees of freedom of gravity on the edges and localizing them in the vertices. So there's two complementary point of views. There's the holonomy formalism, where we localize, we think that the degrees of freedom of gravity have a connection along the edges. And then the dynamics is going to excite this connection and create curvature. And on the other hand, you've got a more formalism like the UN framework, which is more focused on the vertices and the intertwiners that represent chunks of 3D space. And then the dynamics is going to deform these chunks of space. And this spinor formalism allows to go from one to the other because both of these intertwiners and holonomies are just function of a single set of variables. So that's from the canonical point of view. From the spin form point of view, the covariant spin form, the first natural idea is that since spin form compute transition amplitude between spin networks, you can compute a transition amplitude between coherent spin networks, which are picked on classical spinor data. And so the spinors will be the natural boundary data for these spin form amplitudes. But you can go further and not only put the spinors on the boundary, but also put them in the bulk, and we'll be able to express the whole spin form amplitudes as some integrals over the spinor variables. And that turned out to be a very powerful mathematical tool to evaluate exactly the spin form amplitudes and define the generating functions for the spin form amplitudes and the free NJ symbols and extend the non-coherent structure of the spin form models. And finally, one thing I really like is that the Hamiltonian constraint will then be implemented as some differential equation in the spinor variables, which are satisfied by the spin form amplitude and can be compared directly to the classical Hamiltonian constraint that you write in the continuum. And then all this spinor stuff got upgraded to Twister so that we could deal not only with SU2, but with the Lorentz group, SL2C. And that allowed us to develop a more four-dimensional covariant point of view on this whole thing. So especially it allowed us to look a bit more into the simplistic constraints that reduce classical topological BF theory for SL2C to general relativity. And it led to understanding of equivalence of the SL2C structures constrained by these simplistic constraints and the SU2 phase space of loop quantum gravity. And that was implemented through some non-trivial embedding of T star of SU2 into T star of SL2C. And that was some work by Simone and Wolfgang. And it led them to write the EPRL FK spin form amplitude as a path integral over twisters, which is the like, final result of all this approach up to now. So let me tell you a bit more about the phase space of these spinor variables. So I'll first go back to the standard phase space of loop quantum gravity. So in terms of holonomy and flux variables. So you work on a fixed graph, and on the edges, you're going to put an SU2 group element, which is the holonomy. And then for all the edges around every vertex, you're going to put a vector, which lives actually in the SU2 Lie algebra, which are called X. And these variables form a T star of SU2 Poisson algebra, where basically the connection commutes with each other, and then the vectors act as SU2 generators on these holonomies. And we have constraints. We have a trivial constraint, which means that along an edge, the holonomy along that edge defines a 3D rotation, which maps the vector at the source vertex onto the vector at the target vertex up to a switch of orientation, which is this little sign. And then you've got closure constraint around every vertices, which means that the sum of all the vectors around the vertex vanishes. And this constraint is first class and generates local SU2 invariants of loop gravity at every vertex of the graph. So first, this phase space doesn't come out of nowhere. It comes from a discretization of a continuous phase space of loop gravity. So basically, the holonomies are defined as the integral of the connection along the edges. And then you can integrate the triad field by suitably parallel transporting it to a fixed point. And this defines the vectors. But beyond the link with the continuous theory, we are also able to give an interpretation of this phase space as some discrete geometries, which are twisted geometries. So basically, the closure constraint is going to say that you can build a convex polyhedra dual to every vertex of my graph. Basically, each edge incoming to a fixed vertex is going to be dual to a face. And so if you have n edges, you're going to have a polyhedra with n faces. And the vectors living on these edges are going to be the normal vectors to these faces. And then you're going to glue these dual polyhedras together by simply match along the edges. And there's only one thing. It's some area matching, since basically if you look at one edge between two vertices, two polyhedra, then the vector here was mapped on the vector there by a rotation. So the norm of this vector is the same as the norm of this one. So basically, the area of these two surfaces are equal. So this leads to twisted geometries, which are actually a generalization of rigid geometries, but which accounts for torsion. And as I read in a paper by Carlo, the torsion here really accounts from the fact that we have a connection which is not the spin connection defined in terms of a triad. So what it means here, roughly, is that the vectors do not entirely determine the holonomy. So of course, the holonomy is going to map along one edge, is going to map this vector onto the next vector. So what you can do, you can decompose that as mapping this vector on some fixed vector on the z-axis, and then this vector onto the second vector. But then you still have an invariance, so that you can have an arbitrary rotation around the z-axis. And that's basically this angle there, which is interpreted as defining the existing curvature at the discrete level, and that you find out that it's canonically conjugate to the area. So basically, the picture of twisted geometries is that you have this flat polyhedras, which define some kind of like face tangent space, and then you're going to glue these chunks of flat space together with curvature and torsion. And of course, you can impose gluing constraint to come back to rigid geometries. But the whole point is that the phase space of loop gravity is more general than these rigid geometries. So first of all, it's pretty misleading to think of these twisted geometries as these polyhedras glued together. I mean, it's a very nice local picture that you think of these polyhedras. But generically, when you glue these polyhedras together, it's not going to make a triangulation, because the areas between two polyhedras are going to match, but the shape of the face is not going to match. So you really cannot think of it as triangulations. Naturally, you realize that the whole geometry that's encoded into the loop gravity phase space is much more than these rigid geometries. And that is something that we should accept. So my point here is that I would like to revisit this phase space, replacing the vectors by spinners, which are going to live in C2. So now around each edge, I mean, for each edge around each vertex, you're going to have a spinner, a ZEV. And so you're going to have a network of spinners on your graph. That's why we call them spinner networks. So the first point is that you can reconstruct all the variables from the spinners, so the holonomies and the vectors. So the vectors are going to be the projection of the spinners onto the Pauli matrices. And then the group elements are going to be the unique group element which sends a spinner at one side of the edge onto the spinner on the other side of the edge. So the point is that unlike there was an arbitrariness in defining the group element matching a vector onto a vector, here we are working for the fundamental representation of SU2. So there's a unique group element which sends a spinner onto a spinner. So there's no more arbitrariness, and you can entirely reconstruct the holonomy from the spinners. So how does that happen? Is that actually the spinner is in C2, which has one more degree of freedom than the vectors, which are in R3. So actually, it has more information. So the whole point of this construction is that these spinners have a canonical Poisson bracket. So the whole phase space is very simple. And then we keep the same constraints. So we still have a closure constraint, which generates a true transformation. And we have area matching constraints, which says that basically the area of a face shared by two polyhedras is the same. So this constraint is actually also a first-class constraint and generates U1 phase transformation on the spinners. And that allows to get rid of this extra degree of freedom that you thought you had put in the spinners, since they have one extra component compared to the vectors. So the point is that this U1 phase is going to disappear almost. So first, the vectors are invariant, are independent of the phase of the spinners. And then the holonomies are going to be invariant under joint phase transformation of the two spinners living on the end points of the edge. So you can get rid of completely these extra phases, except there's one thing left. It's the relative phase between two spinners on one edge. And this is going to define the angle psi, which encodes the exciting curvature, and that's conjugate to the area. So as I said, the Poisson structure is trivial, so you can quantize all that very simply, and you raise the spinners to creation and annihilation operators, just like you would do for harmonic oscillators. From the SU point of view, it reproduces the Schwinger representation of SU2 algebra in terms of harmonic oscillators, and now the area is going to be the total energy of the oscillators. Then you take in account the matching enclosure constraint, and you quantize them, and you recover exactly the Hilbert space of spin network states, where now instead of having wave function of a connection, you'll have holomorphic wave function in the spinners. And then you go on, and you define the harmonic oscillators' coherent states, and then you can group average them and define coherent spin network states, which are picked on classical spinner networks. By this beautiful formula, which defines what we mean by a semi-classical twisted geometry for loop quantum gravity. So one point I'd like to insist is that here, since it's harmonic oscillators, there is no quantization ambiguities. So we just use the normal ordering, putting all annihilation operators on the right and all creation operators on the left. And then everything works perfectly. All the Poisson brackets will become the quantum commutators in the theory. Well, as you know, this works very well for all polynomial observables. But then there can be problems of ambiguities for non-polynomial observables. So for example, if I consider something very important, which is the holonomy along one edge, I get this group element, which is almost polynomial up to an ugly norm factor in the denominator. So the point is that we know how to quantize the holonomy, since it acts on the Hilbert space of functions, of L2 functions on SU2. And you can check that it's basically the normal quantization of this numerator, which is quadratic in the spinners. And then you can regularize these factors by putting some in terms of 2j plus 1 factors on the left, on the right, and it all works perfectly. The only thing here is that, for example, this kind of framework could allows us to test quantization tricks, like Tiemann's trick. For example, when you have factors in the denominator, you could think of generating them from the Poisson bracket with the square root of the norm in the numerator. And you do that, and then you find something very ugly, that you have an anomaly, that the group element doesn't commute with each other, which is amazingly bad. And so although this is just a very simple toy model, it also begs the question whether this kind of tricks in the theory for the harmonic constraint is worthy. So now I've revisited the whole construction of operators and states of loop quantum gravity, but what are they useful for? So I will focus on a vertex of a graph and discuss the UN framework for intertwiners. So why am I focusing on the vertex? It's because it's the basic structure, the basic building block of spin networks. So you have these vertices where you put intertwiners that represent the chunks of 3D volume. So it's essential to understand the structures and how to deform them and what's the geometric interpretation. So the main result is that you have UN deformations which deform these intertwiners at fixed boundary area, and they allow you to explore the whole space of intertwiners. And you can go much further and introduce some basic SU2 invariant operators of which the UN deformations are a subset and which generate all deformation of these intertwiners which fix or not the area. So this can be very useful for many things. It allows you to count intertwiners when you do black hole entropy calculation. You can define coherent intertwiners. It allows you to define, to decompose the holonomies and other loop gravity operators in some elementary operators, which are these basic SU2 invariant operators. And it allows to also to average over the classical ensemble of polyhedras and to trace over the Hilbert space of intertwiners by an integral over the unitary group un, which is a very powerful tool because mathematically these integrals have been studied a lot. In particular, it allows to make a link between with the existence Hubert formula of matrix models. So just very quickly, what's the classical setting? It's exactly my spinner networks, but around a single edge. So I take a single edge with n, a single vertex with n edges coming in there. So you have n spinners on each of these edges with a canonical Poisson bracket. And then you map them on these vectors by projecting them on the Pauli matrices, and you define a closure constraint by requiring that the sum of these vectors vanishes. As I said, it defines a unique dual polyhedra. Unique polyhedra such that these vectors are the normal vectors to the faces. And then these constraints are also first class and generate a true transformation on my polyhedra, which means that I'm considering polyhedras up to 3D rotations. So the phase space I have is basically the symplectic reduction of my space of spinners by SU2, which I define that as the space of frame polyhedra up to 3D rotation. So why have I said frame here? That the dimension of this phase space is 4n minus 6, which is actually n degrees of freedom extra from the space of polyhedras up to 3D rotations, which means that we have n degrees of freedom more, which correspond to the phases of the spinners. So which means that we have extra phases on every face of my polyhedra that you can interpret as some kind of frame, a 2D frame on the face. So then you can define observables, which are basically going to be SU2 invariant observables, which are the scalar products between the spinners and with their duals. So this gives the E's and the F's. You can reconstruct all the usual geometrical data that you want, like the scalar product between vectors from them. But what's very interesting, the two points, is that the Poisson bracket will form a closed Lie algebra, which is always nice when you're considering an algebra of observables. And then these scalar products are actually going to generate the deformation of my polyhedra. So if I look at the action of the E's by the Poisson bracket, it will generate transformation that fix the area, that leaves the area invariant. And then the F's and the complex conjugate will generate transformation which change the area, so decrease it and increase it. So if I look a bit at the UN action at the E's, they will generate a UN action on the spinners, which is this one, which is the natural action of a UN matrix on an object with n entries. So it, as I said, it commutes with the closure constraint and conserves the total area. The important point is that the phases of the spinners are relevant, and this action wouldn't work on only polyhedras defined in terms of 3D vectors. The important point of this construction is that the action is cyclic, and that it allows to map, to obtain every polyhedra from the totally squished configuration, which has only two faces. So you take this, the pancake, and then you do a UN transformation, and you can get anything like a bowl. So this allows us to identify the space of frame polyhedras as some coset of a unitary group by the subgroup, which is U n minus 2 cross SU2, which is actually a Grassmannian space. But since it's a quotient of UN, you can use the Haar measure on UN to define the uniform measure on the space of polyhedra. This allows us to compute all the averages of any polynomial observables in the V's as a polynomial integral over the unitary group. What's important is that it is possible to compute all these integrals. There's many techniques. It's complicated, so I'm not going to show them there. But even better, you can generate all of these polynomial integrals from the Itzigson-Zuber integral, which is a single formula. So you see, it computes the integral over the unitary group of the exponential of U tensor U dagger. So if you expand the exponential, you will get all these integrals here. So for example, from there, you can compute like all the averages of areas of individual phase, or you can compute other things. For example, what's interesting is the second moment, which is the shape tensor, which basically look at the deviation of the polyhedra from the totally spherical configuration. And you find that average is zero, and that its width, its dispersion is going to go to zero as the number of faces grows, which means that as the number of faces grows, the polyhedras are going to be more and more picked on spherical configurations. So what's important here is the link of all this formalism of Lucas congruity with matrix models as defined through the Itzigson-Zuber formula. So then these are harmonic oscillators, and you can quantize them easily. And all observables are going to be raised to differential operators in the spin of variables. And the Poisson bracket will become commutators, and we recover the whole Hilbert space of intertwiners. So what's interesting is that it allows some new decomposition of the intertwiner space. So if you look at the intertwiner space of n-valent intertwiners, then you can decompose them according to the sum of the spins, which is actually the total area. And then each of these subspaces is going to be an irreducible representation of un. And then the E's are going to act on each of these spaces, and the F and F daggers are going to be generalized ladder operators, which allow to go from one to the other. And then you can look at the character of the UN transformation in these representations, and it will generate all the traces of all polynomials in the E's and the V's, which is basically the quantum equivalent of the Hinkson-Zuber formula. So using all these tools, you can define coherent states, coherent intertwined states, by using the creation operators, F-daggers, and then you can see that these coherent states are going to be coherent under the UN action, meaning that they are going to behave exactly like the classical polyhedra, and you can obtain all of these coherent intertwiners by doing UN transformation on the bivalent intertwiner, so the pancake. You can also see that when you project them onto fixed spins, on every face, it will project down to the living special intertwiners that you use in the spin 4 model all the time, and especially in the E-parallel FK models. And you can also see these states as some projection of the SU2 average harmonic oscillator coherent state for a fixed total area, which is very nice because these SU2 average harmonic oscillator states are actually eigenstates of annihilation operators. So you have everything you would want from coherent states. Also a decomposition of identity in terms of Gaussian integrals over the spinner space, which is one of the main formulas when you want to decompose the spin form amplitudes in terms of spinners. So the point is that now you can take these coherent intertwiners and glue them together in some semi-classical coherent spin network states. And then you can write all SU2 invariant operators in terms of E's and F, which are going to be written as differential operators in the spinners. So here it's the holonomy operator. I'm not going to go in detail into that, but just to say that basically the holonomy operators is going to do shifts of plus or minus 1/2 spins on every edge around the loop. But this formalism allows to introduce some generalized holonomy operators, which are just products of E's and F around the loop, which are going to shift all my spins by some precise plus 1/2 or minus 1/2. So in that sense, the generalized holonomies will allow for a finer analysis of the deformation and dynamics of the loop quantum gravity spin network states. So now I've got all this stuff, and I'm ready to use it in spin forms in the next 5 minutes I have. So very quickly, spin forms are a path integral for loop quantum gravity, and they allow to compute transition amplitude between spin network states. So now what you're going to do is that you're going to put coherent spin network state on the boundary, which are labeled by the classical spinner networks, so by classical data, and you're going to compute the transition amplitude, the spin form transition amplitude between these coherent states. From that, you will get some quantum transition amplitude for the classical data from the classical spinner variables. So using these amplitudes, which are not defined in terms of classical data, you can extract classical effective dynamics and the Hamiltonian constraints for the spinner network, as defined by the spin form model that you're considering. So how does that work? That this Hamiltonian constraint will be differential equation in the spinners, which are satisfied by my spin form amplitude expressed in terms of spinners. And these differential equations are basically expressing the invariance of my spin form amplitude with respect to certain deformation of my boundary data, so my boundary geometry. So that these are really some kind of equivalent of the discrete diffeo invariance. So this has been already applied in a few cases with exact results, so the exact Hamiltonian constraint written as a differential equation. For example, in the context of the spin form cosmology introduced by Carlo and Francesca Vidotto, where you basically look at the transition, the spin form transition from nothing to isotropic state on the two vertex graph. But in some work with Mercedes Martin Benito, we showed that if you do that for BF theory, then you will recover effective FRW equation which from the spin form amplitude, which basically have an equation that you get in loop quantum cosmology in the unimproved prescription. So basically, on looking at something that simple, then you recover the actual true Hamiltonian constraint explicitly here. The only point I'd like to show in that slide is that the Hamiltonian constraint that you get from the spin-form model is actually a discretization of the loop gravity Hamiltonian constraint on the Tubertox graph. So everything fits together. And then you get a very nice explicit formula for the spin-form amplitude, and it satisfies a very nice differential equation, which in the isotropic case reduces to something very simple, which corresponds to flat, lambda equal to zero, FRW cosmology without matter. So this is a trivial model. But this was just to show that what's the logic of the approach. But then people did some things less trivial, and you can do that for 3D and 4D BF, and you can write the flatness constraints at differential operators, which act on the spin form amplitude. And that was work by Laurent Fredel and Valentin Bonzon. So these exact results, and with the exact differential equation, I insist that it's all exact. It was all possible because using spin variables, and you have a simple structure of the current spin networks was function. And you have a simple expression of a quantum measure as a Gaussian integral of a spinner. So everything is simple, so you can do many things with them. So now, for a moment, I've put the spinners on the boundary, but you can put them in the bulk in some sense. So what you do in the spin form is that usually you have these four simplices that you glue together by the identity on the intertwiner space. So usually you decompose the identity on the intertwiner space in the spin basis because it's the historical way to do spin networks. But then you can also decompose the identity in terms of the coherent state, in terms of the spinner integral. And then you'll get a full formula for the spin form amplitude in terms of an integral of spinner variables. At the algebraic level, if you're looking at BF theory, you can also see that in a different way. BF theory is just a bunch of product of delta functions of the group. So usually you use the Plancher decomposition, and you decompose the delta function on the representation of the group. But then you can now decompose in this delta function in some quasi-Gaussian integral of the spinner space. And you get the same results. And that allows you to define some kind of coherent version of all the spin form amplitude and some coherent version of the free NJ symbols. So these are going to be the evaluation of the current spin networks on the identity. So these are the basic building blocks of the spin form amplitude. And the very important point is that it's possible to compute these explicitly. And that was some very nice work by Laurent and his student Jeff. And what that showed is that you can also not only see the coherent spin networks as semi-classical versions of these free NJ symbols, but you should also consider them as generating functionals for these symbols, meaning that the coherent free NZ symbols are going to be sum of some polynomials in the spinners times the free NJ symbols. So why are generating functionals interesting? That, for example, if you look at their poles, it contains information about the asymptotics of spin-form models. But why do I care about asymptotics? Is that it's through the asymptotics I make the link between spin-form models and the space-time geometry. For instance, usually you consider the large spin or the large spinner limit, and then the spin form amplitudes are related to the exponential of the cosine of a rejection with usually some modification. And it's from this mapping that you have some geometrical interpretation of a spin form structure as some discrete spacetime, at least for large spin. And talking about asymptotics, I'd like to advertise a result, which was actually not by me, but by Laurent and Jeff. But Jeff gave a nice talk about it a couple of days ago. And that we looked at the asymptotics of a free NJ symbol, and they found some generalized rejection, which accounts for the torsion, which is present in twisted geometries. So one point I'd like to insist here, it's that there's an interplay between the spin basis, the spin form amplitude expressed in the spin basis, and where you have recursion relations, which express the action of Hamiltonian constraint on the spin networks, with differential equations which act on coherent spin networks, which can be considered as a generating functional for these amplitudes expressing the spin basis. And all this actually allows this recursion relation of this differential equation are an expression of invariance of my spin four model under diffeomorphism, under the Hamiltonian constraints. So now I will give a 1 minute presentation of twister networks, which basically I will say that there are some nice papers on that, and that you should go to Simone's talk that was on last Monday, if you want to know more. But very quickly, what happens is that before you had that graph and you had a spinner network, and now instead of having spinners on every edge around the vertex, you're going to put a twister. What's a twister? Basically, it's a couple of spinners. And then you can define a complex array matching, complex closure constraint, and you can introduce the simplicity constraint, and you can solve them. And what it shows is that the left spinner is going to be equal to the right spinner up to a boost and up to a phase, which is the Imisi angle. And from that, you will see that you can effectively reduce the twisters when you account for the simplicity constraint to a spinner network, but it has a non-trivial embedding. And then you can quantize the whole thing and write the EPL FK amplitude as an integral of a twister space, which is these beautiful formulas that I just told from a talk by Simone. But beyond the EPL FK amplitude, you can also investigate alternative quantization scheme of this simplicity constraint, since this phase space is very simple, and so you can see, you can play with the simplicity constraint and see how to quantize them. And here I will mention just one proposal I did with Maite Laurent and somebody else, and about the holomorphic simplicity constraint, which is a different way to see the simplicity constraint. But now, just before concluding, I'd like to just talk briefly about an idea that I really like, which shows all this spinner and twister thing. It's the coarse graining of spinner network or spin networks. So for a moment, when I talked about intertwiners, I was talking about a single point on my graph. But now, what I'd like to do is coarse grain. So look at bigger regions, bounded regions of my spinner networks. And if you look at the vectors which live on the edges crossing the boundary, you will find that they do not satisfy the closure constraint. And that happens as soon as you've got non-trivial curvature inside. So basically, as soon as you excite the curvature, my region cannot be mapped anymore trivially into flat space-time, into flat space, and so the closure constraint is going to be broken. But can I still map it to something which is a closed polyhedra? So the answer is actually yes. It was surprisingly easy that there exists a unique boost in SL2C which maps any configuration of non-closed spinners onto a configuration of closed spinners, meaning that somehow my region didn't look closed, but I changed frame, and I have got a closed polyhedra. And so, what I wanted to show by there is that from going from spinner, when you want to consider the coarse graining of spinner networks, you will naturally have to go from spinners to twisters and consider some kind of spinner networks where the time normal is different everywhere, so you cannot do a global edge fixing. So I'd like to conclude with many projects which are in progress or which I'd like to people or me to look at using this formalism. But the thing I'd like to insist on is the links between the link between this formalism and the spinorial and twistorial methods which are used in many other approaches to quantum gravity. So I hope you had an impression that these methods are something very promising for quantum gravity, and thank you very much for your attention.
Just a quick precision, because you were citing a recent work by Carlo Rovelli, Han Algard, Wolfgang Wieland, and myself on twisted geometries, and the result of that paper is that the twisting in twisted geometry does not code torsion, because it is possible to define a torsionless spin connection.
Yeah, but the point is that there's also a torsion. There's the torsionless thing, and there's the torsion beside.
Simone. So you are suggesting to take the spinor formalism as sort of more fundamental to continue progress in blue quantum gravity. Usually, in terms of the holonomies and fluxes, we know how to take the this projective limit in which we end up having a continuum Hilbert space defined by the generalized connections with Abai and Yezio's measure. And I was wondering, can you do the same procedure starting from the spinorial framework and get a description of the continuum Hilbert space? Can you show some unitary equivalence between these two representations?
So you're asking about if I can have a continuous formulation of this or the spinor thing. I've tried to do it, but not a lot, and I'm still trying to do it. So I don't know the answer yet. But I mean, at the continuum level, you've got the connection and the triad. But now, as you see, if you use the spinors, you've got some extra U1 phase. And so you need to put, it will be some variables which contains a bit more than the A and the E, but the connection and triad. Then you should have an extra constraint which generates invariants under the U1 transformations. So I haven't done it yet, but it seems very similar to the old people. I mean, people that worked on the initial formulation of loop quantum gravity in terms of the spinor indices before we actually use. But yeah, I don't know yet. Sorry?
Twisters were originally introduced to code the conformal properties of field theory in Minkowski space, the conformally invariant properties. And gravity is famously not conformally invariant. In extending to a twistorial formulation, do you see any role for conformal or Weyl transformations coming into loop quantum gravity?
not really. I haven't really looked into that. I know that Simone, with some postdoc, started looking into that, and they looked at this conformal transformation that you can have from this spin from this twister stuff, but it didn't look like the usual conformal transformation that do changes of scale. It looked a bit different. So it's some scale which is not actually the area or something. It's something more internal. So I don't really know the link with this approach of twisters in the typical, the usual one.
Let us think, Etera. Thank you.